The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Samantha Vincenti is titled, "The Pandemic Has Caused a Gossip Shortage." A few days ago, I heard a piece of gossip that I've been mentally palming like a piece of gold ever since. I'm greedily hunched over it like the Lord of the Rings Gollum obsessing about his precious after lonely centuries in the Misty Mountains, a relatable scenario after so much pandemic isolation. I deeply miss gossip, juicy, real-deal, jaw-dropping gossip. And by extension, I miss my interconnected network of people who go outside to places and get up to something, whereupon my friends and I can discuss that scandalous something over drinks. Yes, gossip has potentially toxic properties, but it's also the glue that holds our bonds together. We've never needed the fizzy respite of good gossip more. It's been a relentless, brutal, important year, replete with a tumultuous presidential election and a string of horrific high-profile incidents that forced Americans into long-overdue dialogues about police violence and the Black Lives Matter movement. The United States' ongoing coronavirus pandemic has left us grappling with our collective growing pains and fears, mostly in private, as everyone with the privilege to do so has spent the majority of our time indoors, separated from family and friends. In the first 4 months of quarantine, I parented an 18-month-old full-time while simultaneously doing my job remotely, interviewing people from odd corners of my apartment with sticky fingers in my hair and 1,000 unread emails in my inbox. My son has now spent half of his life hugged by no one but his parents. He's lost one grandparent to COVID-19 and nearly lost another. Stress has aged my body so much that I'm basically the afterphoto of an American president after 8 years in office. But with my health and employment intact, this is what lucky looks like right now. I know I'm not the only one who's feeling the gossip void either. We're all of us exhausted, and sweet distraction in the form of light intrigue is the least that we deserve. I see it in the "we've all gotten so boring" tweets that cross my feed. I feel its absence in catch-up sessions with friends when, after we've all blown off some steam via much-needed venting, there's a saggy pocket of silence where gossip used to be. While I'm craving a solid, "can you believe he, she, they did that" story, instead, me and everyone I know are simply changing out of our formal daytime sweatpants to snuggle into a Netflix binge each night before bed. Remember being out past 9 p.m.? And for me, tisking over maskless social gatherings isn't a satisfying substitute for hijinks. It's just infuriating. The country has gone from the making sourdough bread while watching Tiger King era of quarantine to the an alarming swath of the American population has decided this pandemic is over. Yet no matter how badly we wish it so, not one of us has returned to all doors open normalcy, the kind that sets the stage for the kind of drama I crave. One night stands and secret love affairs. Trying too long visits from people's impossible relatives. Lavish parties in which someone either falls or tumble fights into a pool. Sorry, I've been watching reruns of The OC and it's been so long since I've heard actual gossip that I struggle to even name a more realistic third example. Moira Rose of Schitt's Creek once said that gossip is the devil's telephone, best to just hang up. Many spiritually minded books on the topic agree, casting it as a morally bad practice to avoid. But despite its destructive potential, research has found that gossip is not a sin, nor is it even avoidable. In fact, it often serves a valuable social purpose. We see it in community spaces like corner bars and hair salons, where trading secondhand tales is more than a way to pass the time. It's social currency. Gossip is necessary, says Megan L. Robbins, associate professor of psychology at UC Riverside, adding that it's a global phenomenon that occurs across every demographic. Robbins and her research colleagues define gossip as just talking about someone who's not present, whether that chatter is negative, positive, or neutral. In fact, a 2019 analysis Robbins co-authored, titled Who Gossips and How in Everyday Life, found that 3/4 of the observed subjects' gossip was neutral, bordering on dull. About 9% of the talk was positive. June got that promotion she wanted, for example, or Harry's haircut looks great. The rest, roughly 15%, was negative. Another finding, younger people tended to negatively gossip more than older ones. Even when sharing a negatively slanted tale about a mutual acquaintance or friend, gossip can have a bonding effect, Robbins says. It does signal a, hey, you're in on this, and I'm trusting you not to relay it to that other person. She points to psychologist Roy Baumeister's theories of gossip as a form of cultural learning, which posits that gossip serves to solidify bonds and affirm a culture's norms and values. When you hear about what someone did, you can tell by the way the person's relaying it whether it's a good thing to do or if it's something that you really shouldn't, Robbins explains. We learn about what's right and wrong from those stories and how people tell them. Robbins' explanation made me realize I haven't just been missing the dished dirt. I'm experiencing a deficit of true stories about people I know when I was so used to being inundated with accounts of their comings and goings. So what's a gossip lover to do in a drought? Celebrity gossip has become a bigger stand-in for our own personal excitement than ever before. Witness the rise of De Moi, the popular Instagram blind item account that shares the daily celebrity sightings and alleged canoodling tea that so many of us are thirsting for. Robbins, who's noticed that her own interest in Hollywood gossip has risen in the pandemic, says that may be a byproduct of our natural human need for scuttlebutt, given that there's currently a nationwide shortage. Still, it doesn't quite hit the spot the same way for me, likely because, sadly, Harry Styles isn't in my social circle. Robbins suggests casting your social net a little wider than you have been, so I've resolved to push through my late pandemic Zoom fatigue and redouble my efforts to connect. If you're reaching out to more people, you're more likely to get some good gossip from somebody, she laughs. Personal pleasure of hearing a juicy item aside, Robbins reminds me that deep down, gossip is not all I miss. I think ultimately what we're looking for when we seek that kind of entertainment is social connection, she says. While I know she's onto something, I do miss the wow factor. So maybe I'll try some manufactured drama next. Which Housewives franchise is the best one to start with? Our next article by Rachel Rifkin is titled, Two Sisters Took a DNA Test, and it revealed that everything they knew about their family was wrong. It all started out innocently enough. In 2017, Audrey Bell, a 51-year-old mother of triplets from Long Island, hopped on the internet to purchase a 23andMe testing kit to help her figure out which of her triplets were the identical siblings and which was the fraternal sibling. But when she received the results weeks later, they revealed something curious. The test was able to correctly identify which of her triplets was the fraternal sibling, but while their heritage was categorized as Southern European, the ancestry composition didn't mention anything specifically about Italy. That struck Bell as odd, since her father, Richard Palmadesso, had always been so proud of his Italian ancestry. She mentioned the results to her twin, Cynthia McFadden, her younger sister, Stephanie Palmadesso, and her parents, who were also confused about the lack of Italian ancestry. Cynthia and Audrey are twin sisters who go by their married last names. Still, no one seemed to think much of it at the time. Then, at the end of 2019, Cynthia also decided to take a 23andMe test. Similarly, she was surprised to see that she had no Italian heritage. The sisters didn't know what to make of their results and grew more suspect this time around. Their father had passed away in 2017, so by this point they couldn't ask him any questions or have him take his own DNA test. So they turned to their father's closest known living relative, a first cousin who also happens to be named Richard Palmadesso, and asked him to take a DNA test too. His results confirm that the sisters were, in fact, not related to the Palmadesso family. Unlike Audrey, Cynthia had decided to select the option for 23andMe to reveal any DNA relative connections in their database. She had matched with a person named Tom Martin, so Audrey decided to go back to her profile and turn on her DNA connections too. Tom Martin also popped up as a match for her, saying the twins both shared 22% of their DNA with the man, which would make Tom either their grandfather or uncle. The twins decided to reach out to Tom via 23andMe, and they soon learned that he was a 79-year-old retiree living in Florida who had decided to test his DNA for a very specific and unusual reason. He had been trying to find his missing younger brother, Gerald Jerry Martin, for decades. Tom told the sisters that on July 9, 1945, Jerry, just 2 days shy of his fourth birthday, was kidnapped while he and Tom, then six, were out riding bikes together near their home in the Hell's Kitchen neighborhood of New York City. As Tom recalls, the brothers were approached by a woman offering them candy. Jerry went off with the woman to get the candy, and Tom waited with the bikes. Jerry never came back. Cynthia and Audrey wondered, could their father, who they knew all their lives as Richard Palmadesso, actually be Jerry Martin? Today, child kidnappings involving strangers are a rare occurrence in the United States, making up just about 1% of the cases the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children worked on in 2019. But we can't be certain about the frequency or details of any kidnappings that took place before the 1980s, when the 1983 Missing Children's Assistance Act was created and a national registry was established for missing children. What we do know is that in the first half of the 20th century, there were plenty of infant and child abductions, mostly for the purpose of black market adoption, but also directly by women who wanted to be mothers but couldn't become pregnant for one reason or another. Whether there had been a national database at the time or not, it still would have been hard to put these incidents into numbers, because oftentimes people didn't discover that a kidnapping had occurred until decades later, if at all. With no DNA testing available at the time, families might not know that the children they raised were not biologically theirs for several reasons. A mistake could have been made at a hospital, or a kidnapping could have been covered up. But during the first half of the 20th century, a common kidnapper profile was a woman unable to have children who felt pressure from her partner or society to have one, often to maintain her relationship. There's been a profile about women who steal children to raise as their own among police departments since the 1920s, said Paula Fass, author of Kidnapped, Child Abduction in America, referring to a description of common psychological traits that law enforcement uses to categorize certain types of criminals. You can imagine that if they had a profile, these were not isolated cases. With few job opportunities and other means of achieving financial independence, not to mention societal expectations and fear of domestic violence, these women didn't always feel like divorce was a good option, Fass says. Sometimes going as far as gaining weight to appear pregnant and buying new baby gear, they were known to steal infants from hospitals or homes. This was easier to accomplish back then than you might think. From the early 1900s to the 1940s, when hospital births were not as common, lax standards made it easier to snatch babies. Hospitals had also not yet developed standard procedures like ID bracelets for identifying mother and baby. Today, the disappearance of baby viewing rooms, policies that keep babies with mothers, and strict security guidelines have made infant abductions and infant switches at hospitals rare. Birth certificates were also easy to fake before 1946, when the National Office of Vital Statistics began issuing and keeping track of them. Earlier birth certificates didn't have as much information as they do today, nor were they given to people born at home, and back then home births still represented a large percent of all births. In fact, before World War II, up to 200,000 people were born in the U.S. every year that never got birth certificates. Around the same time, adoption became harder. During the baby boom years, stigma around being an unwed mother lessened and access to contraception and abortions increased. If you were a childless couple who wanted a kid, you could adopt from a reputable adoption agency. But if you were unwilling to wait or were rejected by an agency and had the money, you might turn to black market adoption agencies. Black market adoption agencies relied on pregnant, unwed mothers who were often pressured or outright coerced into giving up their babies, or the agencies might turn to kidnapping. During the late 1940s and early 1950s, children were stolen by these adoption rings, Fass says. There was such a premium placed on having children that it was worthwhile for doctors to sacrifice their careers. They'd have the mothers, who were often young women and teenagers, sign their children over before they really knew what they were doing. According to Fass, if a person or couple wanted a child and couldn't afford an upstanding adoption agency or a black market option, it's entirely possible that they might kidnap and raise a child as their own. In the past, the discovery of these kind of kidnappings was rare, but with the proliferation of DNA tests, cases have become more common. Back in 1945, after Jerry's kidnapping, his father Harold filed a report with the local police station. The New York Daily News also wrote an article about the incident, which mentions that the police suspected Tom and Jerry's biological mother, Nancy, had taken her younger son because she and Harold had recently gone through a contentious split. At that point, Harold was already with another woman with whom he had a one-year-old daughter named Mary. He would go on to have two more children with his second partner. But according to Mary and Tom, Nancy was never proven to have anything to do with Jerry's disappearance. Over the years, Harold, and eventually Tom, would check in with the local police station for breaks in the case to no avail. The kidnapping hung over the whole family for decades. According to Mary, until the day Harold died, he was convinced that Jerry was out there somewhere, still alive. Suspecting that Richard Palmadesso was, in fact, the missing Jerry Martin, Cynthia asked her brother-in-law, who was in law enforcement, to look into the cold case. When he couldn't find the file, the family was told it was possible it had been destroyed in a fire at the precinct. The New York Daily News article was one of only a few pieces of evidence the twins could find that revealed any details of the kidnapping. But as the women got to know Tom better, more similarities and clues popped up, backing up the DNA results. After exchanging photos, they discovered that Tom and Richard looked strikingly similar. When they met Tom in person for the first time, around Thanksgiving of 2019, they discovered the similarities didn't end there. The funny thing is, when we met our Uncle Tom, we found out he loves a lot of the same things our dad did, McFadden says. They both loved coconut cake and movies and acting. Uncle Tom even had some headshots from when he was younger and wanted to be an actor. So many things lined up, but the question remained. If Richard was Jerry, did the Palmadesso family know he was kidnapped? What did they know? And who knew? According to his birth certificate, Richard Palmadesso was born in Staten Island on May 31, 1943, to Isabel and Angelo Palmadesso. Until then, Isabel and Angelo did not have children of their own together, but Isabel, who was in her 40s, already had two daughters in their 20s from a previous relationship. When Richard was 12, Isabel passed away, and Richard was sent to live with his uncle, Giacomo Jack Palmadesso, Angelo's brother. Richard stayed with his uncle's family until he graduated from high school, but barely kept in contact with any family members after he moved out. Angelo died when Richard was 27. Richard's daughters knew that Angelo had served in World War II for approximately 2 years, arriving home to Staten Island in September 1945. They began to speculate that it was possible Isabel became pregnant right before Angelo left for the war and maybe miscarried. Or possibly, for whatever reason, she had lied and told Angelo that she was pregnant. With the Nazi surrender to the Allies on May 7, 1945, and Angelo's impending return in sight, did Isabel realize she needed to produce a 2-year-old son for Angelo when he arrived home and decide to kidnap Jerry? It was certainly possible. Unfortunately, there was no way for the sisters to prove their theory. While Isabel did appear to fit some elements of the profile of someone who would kidnap a child to raise as her own at the time, other pieces of the situation were out of step. What's unusual about this case is that the child was stolen at the age of 4, Fass says. Normally in these types of cases, the children are infants because the women want to make their husbands think the child is theirs. But what was even harder to understand was how the situation might have been explained to little Jerry if he had indeed been taken directly to the Palmadesos home in Staten Island after being abducted from Manhattan. That he had a new name and new parents. That instead of turning 4, he was now 2. Today, Tom, Mary, Audrey, and Cynthia are in constant contact by phone, text, and Facebook. They celebrate each other's special occasions, remotely for now, and the sisters share special memories of their dad with Tom and Mary. Earlier this year, Mary gifted Tom framed pictures of the time the sisters visited them in Florida. She gave them to him for Father's Day, since he never had any children of his own. Mary and Tommy are very warm and loving and have accepted us with open arms, Cynthia says. Still, for Audrey and Cynthia, it's been sad to find out that their father may have been kidnapped because he never had the chance to meet brothers and sisters that he could have been very close with. Nancy and Harold have 5 children together, including Tom and Jerry. Even though there's still so many unanswered questions, the DNA tests unraveled information that offered the women further insights into their dad. While he could be kind, funny, and silly, he also suffered from bipolar disorder and constant anxiety, and there was always a disconnect between him and his family that the twins could never understand. Now it seemed to make more sense as to why most of the Palmadesso family didn't keep in touch with Richard and made little or no effort to get to know his wife and children. Tom seems to have gained some closure as well. He gets upset that they didn't find each other in time to meet again, but is happy knowing that my father had a family that loved and cared for him, Audrey says. He is certain that my dad is now finally back together with his real mother and father. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled, When Asian Elders Felt Unsafe Walking Alone, These Volunteers Stepped Up. I have to go at 3, August Wood tells me at the start of our interview. I have to go meet the ladies. It's hard to express how delightful these women are. Wood, a 52-year-old communications professional, volunteers twice a week with Compassion in Oakland, a free service that pairs Asian elders with chaperones who can walk them safely to their destinations. After we finished speaking, Wood took a 20-minute bus ride from our Oakland apartment to escort a group of friends from the Rose of Sharon assisted living facility on their weekly walk around Lake Merritt. The friends, who are all immigrants from Asia, have been making the 3.4-mile loop for years. But given the spate of violence against Asian elders around the country, and especially within San Francisco's Bay Area, they haven't felt safe walking alone this past year. I get to walk with these ladies who are so charming, but the reality is I'm only there because they're scared. People in their community are being targeted. They don't know if they can leave the house, Wood says. Since March 2020, the United States has seen a sharp rise in attacks against members of the AAPI community. Data collected by the group Stop AAPI Hate revealed more than 2,800 firsthand accounts of anti-Asian acts across the U.S. between March 2020 and February 2021. Of that set, 9% were physical assaults, and 7% involved victims over the age of 60. Compassion in Oakland, which now has over 1,000 volunteers, was originally formed in February 2021 as one man's response to these attacks. Jacob Azevedo, 26, was shocked by the statistics and by the gruesome stories of Asian elders being harmed in his native Bay Area. In January, an 84-year-old Thai immigrant died in San Francisco after he was pushed to the pavement by a man who suddenly approached him. A February video shows a 91-year-old Asian American man shoved to the ground in Oakland's Chinatown. Police said his assailant went on to attack 2 other Asian Americans, a 60-year-old man and a 55-year-old woman, that same day. Bloomberg reports that Oakland's Chinatown saw 18 attacks against Asian Americans in 2 weeks in February. That same month, Azevedo offered to walk as a chaperone with a post on his Instagram account, which garnered 20,000 likes, hundreds of offers to help in the comments, and an interview on ABC News. "Help us make our elderly community here in Oakland feel a little safer to walk down the street," Jacob said on the post. Azevedo selected Compassion in Oakland's first cohort of volunteers from emails that landed in his inbox. More offers came from a GoFundMe fundraiser inspired by his initial Instagram post, with proceeds going to purchase hand alarms for the elderly. Jacob has the biggest heart. He was so tired of hearing of these attacks. He said, "I'm not a big buff guy, but I'll walk with you," Katrina Ramos, Compassion in Oakland's co-founder, tells Oprah Daily. Ramos reached out to Azevedo after seeing his post, as did fellow co-founder Jess Aoyoung, a full-time college counselor. All three took on leadership positions within the rapidly growing organization. Compassion in Oakland now offers two services. During weekend patrol shifts, pods of three or four volunteers travel an area of 16 square blocks, spreading the word about their service via flyers as well as speaking to shop owners. The volunteers always include a speaker fluent in Mandarin or Cantonese, two widely spoken Chinese dialects. The volunteers range in age, race, and ethnic backgrounds. Then, during the week, Compassion in Oakland also offers a hotline so that volunteers can meet elders at a specific location and a pre-planned time and walk them to their destinations. One of the early volunteers, Amy Wong, recalls that at first, people were hesitant to accept the group's help. "Now that the trust has been built, people are approaching us. The response has gone from nothing to a cascade of requests," Wong says, referring to calls placed for chaperone services during the week. The group's founders estimate that it reaches hundreds of elders a month. On walks, volunteers, especially those who speak Cantonese, the predominant language spoken among the area's Asian elders, hear stories that describe an atmosphere of fear. One weekend, Aoyoung met a group of women who first turned down Compassion in Oakland services, but then returned to the volunteers to ask for help because they were scared walking back to their apartment slightly outside of Oakland's Chinatown, 16 square block radius. "They used to walk that 15-minute walk home freely. They were telling us that there are people in their building that don't leave because they're so scared. They feel like prisoners," Aoyoung says. Upon returning to their apartment building, the women recommended Compassion in Oakland to their neighbors. Becky Koch, who moved to the United States in 2007 from Hong Kong, heard about the rise in violence from her group chats. Speaking to Oprah Daily through a translator, Koch says she used to rely on her son and daughter to drive her to destinations. Then she heard about Compassion in Oakland, first from a flyer and then from a neighbor. A volunteer accompanied Koch to three dentist visits in Chinatown. "This service saved me. It made me feel secure," she says. According to the co-founders, most elders know someone who has been harassed. "Everybody has a story," Ramos says, "but often these crimes go unreported. It's embedded in the culture to move on and not speak about it. You don't want to cause trouble. You don't want to be the person who is too loud and draw attention to yourself. Culturally, that was something that maybe for a time helped people survive, but it doesn't work anymore," Aoyoung says. "Younger generations are changing that." Compassion in Oakland is one of the many groups around the country attempting to create a sense of security among the neighborhood's AAPI elders. Volunteers are donating air horns to local businesses. The service Cali Chi Cab offers reimbursement for elders who have to travel long distances via Lyft. Asians with Attitude, led by two Bay Area fathers and their children, is another patrol group formed in the wake of the attacks. Among this sea, Compassion in Oakland volunteers are visible for their goldenrod shirts, contrasted, say, with volunteers for Oakland Chinatown Chamber of Commerce who wear blue. "They walk in a big line. We see each other and wave as we pass," Wood says. The patrol groups operate on the principle of safety in numbers. "This is a community that looks out for each other, and they will protect each other. Hopefully this will discourage people from committing violent crimes," Wong says. Unfortunately, the need for these groups' existence continues to assert itself. In late April, Carl Chan, the president of Oakland's Chinatown Chamber of Commerce, who had spoken out against the year's earlier attacks, was himself the victim of a hate crime. While these incidents of race-based violence are now inciting national outrage, the residents of Oakland's Chinatown have long been aware of this problem. The elders are saying it's nice that there's been a response, but this isn't new. They've been harassed on the bus for their whole entire lives, Ao Young says. Just as the problem is not new, it is not limited to Oakland. According to Compassion in Oakland's founders, the largest spike in volunteers came following an attack on the other side of the country. On March 26, the gunman opened fire at three spas in Atlanta, Georgia, murdering six women of Asian descent and eight people total. This act of race-motivated violence led to an influx in volunteers. The group more than doubled its size that week. It showed people this is a bigger issue than they were wanting to admit and recognize, Ao Young says. In the months to come, Compassion in Oakland is expanding to San Francisco and the San Gabriel Valley in Southern California, and are looking to other cities with a sizable population of Asian elders. Slowly, we'll have the whole city of Oakland and beyond covered in these shirts, Ao Young says. So far, Compassion in Oakland's strategy appears to be working. There has not been a reported incident of violence on one of their patrols. For the co-founders, the real measure of success is more ineffable than what statistics provide. Ao Young says, "It's beautiful to see how relieved these elders are feeling. They say, 'You guys see us.'" But the group's success is also bittersweet. "In a perfect world, we wouldn't need this service," Ramos says. "These attacks wouldn't be happening. People wouldn't feel scared." Our next article by Monica Chan is titled "Vice President Kamala Harris's Parents Met During the Civil Rights Movement." Vice President Kamala Harris had a supportive roster of family members by her side throughout the years. From her husband, Douglas Emhoff, to her accomplished sister Maya and her stepchildren, the history-making politician has taken to social media over the years to share plenty about the loved ones she holds dear. One important part of her backstory is her biracial African-American and Indian-American identity she inherited from her parents. Shamala Gopalan and Donald Harris, who both immigrated to the United States from India and Jamaica respectively, to pursue doctorate degrees at the University of California, Berkeley. "My parents marched and shouted in the civil rights movement of the 1960s. It's because of them and the folks who also took to the streets to fight for justice that I am where I am," Harris wrote on Instagram. "They laid the path for me as only the second black woman ever elected to the United States Senate." Although Gopalan and Harris eventually divorced in 1971, the two were an accomplished duo. After graduating, Gopalan went on to become a prominent cancer researcher, while Harris remains a professor of economics emeritus at Stanford University. Here's what we know about the parents who helped shape Harris from a young age. Shamala and Donald first met in Berkeley, California. They both immigrated to the United States to receive doctorate degrees at the University of California, Berkeley. The two met and fell in love at Berkeley while participating in the civil rights movement, according to Harris's autobiography, The Truths We Hold. Shamala's marriage and her decision to stay in the United States were the ultimate acts of self-determination and love. They were active in the civil rights movement. They even took a young Kamala to some of the marches. According to a 2004 clip from the Los Angeles Times, a favorite family story begins with Harris's parents pushing her in a stroller as they marched for civil rights, joining in the protest chants. After one march, Harris's mom innocuously asked, "What do you want, Kamala?" The toddler replied, "Feed 'em." Kamala Harris's mom was a prominent breast cancer researcher. "My mother was a pioneering breast cancer researcher, so I grew up learning about the importance of screening and early detection," Harris shared in an Instagram post during Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Shamala's work took her to many top research institutions, including University of Illinois, University of Wisconsin, Department of Medicine at McGill University in Montreal, as well as Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. She made substantial contributions to the field of hormones and breast cancer, publishing her research in countless journals and receiving numerous honors, according to her obituary. Shyamala was the daughter of an Indian diplomat and a women's rights activist. When I was a young girl visiting my grandparents in India, I joined my grandfather and his buddies on their morning walk along the beach as they would talk about the importance of fighting for democracy and civil rights, Harris wrote in an Instagram post. Those walks made me who I am today. In addition, Shyamala's mother, Rajam, was a role model to the young Harris daughters due to her work for women's rights. Kamala comes from a long line of kick-ass women, Shyamala told the Los Angeles Times. She was very engaged with the news. For as long as I could remember, my mother loved to watch the news and read the newspaper, Vice President Harris wrote in a New York Times op-ed. When Maya and I were kids, she'd insist we sit down in front of Walter Cronkite each night before dinner. She also raised Harris and her sister as strong black women. My mother was very intentional about raising my sister Maya and me as strong black women, Harris noted on social media. She coupled her teachings of civic duty and fearlessness with actions, which included taking us on Thursday nights to Rainbow Sign, a black cultural center near our home. There we were always greeted with warm hugs and exposed to extraordinary people like Shirley Chisholm, Nina Simone, and Maya Angelou, who helped show us what we could become. In her 2018 autobiography, Harris explained her mother's thinking. She knew that her adopted homeland would see Maya and me as black girls, and she was determined to make sure we would grow into confident black women. Shyamala passed away in 2009. It was one of the worst days of my life, Vice President Harris wrote in a New York Times opinion piece, reflecting on the day in 2008 when her mom told her she was diagnosed with colon cancer. Despite receiving chemotherapy treatments, Shyamala passed away on February 11, 2009. Are my daughters going to be okay? Was one of the last questions Shyamala asked the hospice nurse. And according to Harris, she was focused on being our mother until the very end. She added, and though I miss her every day, I carry her with me wherever I go. I think of the battles she fought, the values she taught me, her commitment to improve health care for us all. There is no title or honor on earth I'll treasure more than to say I am Shyamala Gopalan Harris's daughter. Ahead of her inauguration, Harris said in an interview with NPR, I will be thinking about my mother who is looking down from heaven. I will be thinking about all the people who are counting on us to lead and are counting on us to see them and to address their needs and the things that keep them up at night. And I'll be thinking about the fact that we both have to hit the ground running immediately to support the people of our country, to support the children of our country, and to help us get out of the crises that we're facing. Donald Harris was born in Jamaica. According to Harris's 2018 autobiography, Donald was born in Jamaica in 1938 and immigrated to the United States to get his doctorate degree from the University of California, Berkeley. He eventually became a naturalized United States citizen. Harris's dad is a professor of economics emeritus at Stanford University. According to the Stanford Department of Economics, Donald joined the faculty in 1972 after 3 years as a tenured professor at University of Wisconsin-Madison. At Stanford, he taught undergraduate classes like Theory of Capitalist Development, as well as working with graduate students in a new program called Alternative Approaches to Economic Analysis. Donald stayed on at Stanford until 1998, when he took early retirement to pursue his long-term interest in developing public policies to promote economic growth and advance social equity. Donald took his daughters to visit Jamaica at an early age. According to an essay Donald wrote for Jamaica Global Online, he tried to show his daughters their heritage through frequent visits to Jamaica and engaging life there in all its richness and complexity. One of the most vivid and fondest memories I have of that early period with my children is of the visit we made in 1970 to Orange Hill, he recounted. We trudged through the cow dung and rusted iron gates, uphill and downhill, along narrow, unkempt paths to the very end of the family property, all in my eagerness to show to the girls the terrain over which I had wandered daily for hours as a boy. He continued, "Upon reaching the top of a little hill that opened much of that terrain to our full view, Kamala, ever the adventurous and assertive one, suddenly broke from the pack, leaving behind Maya the more cautious one, and took off like a gazelle in Serengeti, leaping over rocks and shrubs and fallen branches in utter joy and unleashed curiosity to explore that same enticing terrain. I quickly followed her with my trusted Canon Super 8 movie camera to record the moment, in my usual role as cameraman for every occasion. I couldn't help thinking there and then what a moment of exciting rediscovery being handed over from one generation to another." Donald and Shamala divorced when Harris was 7 years old. After the divorce, Shamala was granted custody of their two daughters. Donald wrote in the Jamaica Global Online essay that his earlier interactions with his children came to an abrupt halt in 1972, and that he lost a hard-fought custody battle in the family court of Oakland, California. Although Harris herself doesn't talk much about her dad as an adult, Donald shared pictures of them together in his 2018 essay and wrote, "Nevertheless, I persisted, never giving up on my love for my children or reneging on my responsibilities as their father." He criticized one of Harris's jokes on the campaign trail, but is staying out of politics for now. In February 2019, as Harris was running her own campaign for president, she made a joke during a radio interview with The Breakfast Club that involved smoking marijuana and her Jamaican heritage, but it didn't go over well with her father. In response, Donald sent a statement to Jamaica Global Online regarding his daughter's joke. "My dear departed grandmothers, whose extraordinary legacy I described in a recent essay on this website, as well as my deceased parents, must be turning in their grave right now to see their family's name, reputation, and proud Jamaican identity being connected in any way, jokingly or not, with a fraudulent stereotype of a pot-smoking joy-seeker and in the pursuit of identity politics," he wrote. "But you probably won't see him getting more involved in the future." According to an email reviewed by Politico, Donald wrote, "I have decided to stay out of all the political hullabaloo by not engaging in any interviews with the media." Our next article by Samantha Vincenti is titled, "How to Deal with Selfish Friends, Family, and Partners." Every relationship has some give and take. But what do you do when you've realized someone in your life is mostly take and no give? Perhaps it's been one-sided for a while, or maybe things have gradually evolved into a toxic dynamic. You meet a friend for ketchup drinks and they unload for 30 solid minutes and forget to ask how you are. A family member constantly asks for favors, yet they're conveniently busy when you're in a jam. Or you've planned thoughtful dates a dozen times over while your significant other hasn't done the same in, well, ever. So how do you break the cycle with someone who seems terminally self-absorbed? Here's what two experts say about dealing with selfish people and how to improve your relationship with them. What causes someone to be selfish? Emotional intelligence exists on a spectrum, and some individuals are higher in emotional intelligence than others, says Lisa Marie Bobby, PhD, a Colorado-based marriage counselor, therapist, and life coach. One symptom of low emotional intelligence is the tendency to be self-absorbed or exclusively concerned about what you're thinking, feeling, needing, and wanting, instead of the thoughts, feelings, needs, and desires of others. Exhausting as a loved one's pattern of selfish behavior may be, Bobby suggests taking a compassionate view of why they may act this way. One thing that I found to be helpful is to conceptualize the way that people are functioning in the context of their life experiences, she says. People who are selfish tend to have been raised in environments in which their feelings, thoughts, and needs weren't recognized or valued. In contrast, from earliest childhood, highly empathetic people have had their feelings and thoughts reflected back to them and at least respected, Bobby continues. In this way, thoughtful and compassionate people are not born, they're made. Likewise, people who have arrived in adulthood without the easy ability to understand or value the emotions of others tend to be products of their environment. Calling out selfish behavior may backfire. The friend or family member who turns every conversation into a monologue probably doesn't realize that they're annoying you at all, since they're not great at picking up other social cues. That lack of self-awareness means that any talking to about their perceived misbehavior may be poorly received, particularly if this is the first they're hearing of it. When people react badly to the people with low emotional intelligence, the latter will often feel genuinely surprised, offended, and even victimized, Bobby explains. While you can certainly try to have a thoughtful conversation, generally speaking, more often than not, attempts to directly confront self-centered behavior and ask for improvement results in defensiveness, minimization, and often unproductive conflict, says Bobby. Setting boundaries is crucial. You can only control your own actions, not anybody else's. This is really less about managing another person and more about setting a boundary around what you're available for and how you react, says Nancy Levin, life coach and author of the upcoming book, Setting Boundaries Will Set You Free. If someone in our lives isn't showing up for us, we can make a direct request around balance, but we also have to be prepared for the other person to not be able to meet us there. There's a saying, don't go to the hardware store for milk, she continues. We have to check ourselves to see if we're trying to get our needs met by someone who isn't willing or able to. Your radio silence can speak volumes. While a full-on ghosting is generally bad relationship practice, Bobby says it's possible to assist a selfish person in examining their own behavior by reining in the time and energy you spend on them. But don't expect overnight results, and change will only happen if they want it to. It's normal and natural to not want to spend as much time with someone who is self-centered and a poor listener, she says. Over time, they may notice that they don't have that many friends or have short-lived relationships, aren't advancing in their careers, or often feel lonely and disconnected. They may start to feel badly about that and wonder why. A lot of self-reflection and a good therapist can work wonders, but it has to be their choice. Often, learning how to actively and empathetically listen, ask open-ended questions, and slow their process down to incorporate the perspectives of others are central to developing stronger relationships going forward, Bobby explains. If you're dating or married to someone who's acting selfish, Bobby suggests breaking things off if you notice selfish behavior early in a relationship. Take self-centered behavior extremely seriously and do not make the mistake that too many people do, especially women, which is to date optimistically. However, in a long-term relationship or marriage, Bobby suggests working it out with a neutral party, such as a counselor. The person who struggles with emotional intelligence skills needs guidance around how to be a more emotionally present partner. However, the person on the other side of the dynamic may also need to work on having acceptance, compassion, and appreciation for their partner as well. Is a selfish friend truly a friend at all? Maybe the answer is yes, but strictly for dish-deep outings like a shopping trip, see Levin's milk metaphor. But according to Bobby, you do better to invest your time and energy into friendships with people who you can have a more balanced and mutually generous relationship. Things get thornier with parents and other family members. Boundaries are often most challenging when it comes to family, and your resentment is likely intertwined with a long interpersonal history. If you find yourself feeling guilty, remember that no is a complete sentence. Learn how to check in with yourself around what you say yes to, says Levin. If the yes is out of fear of someone's disappointment or anger or needing to be the hero, it's a no. The best strategy here may be to lower your expectations dramatically, limit your time together, and look to other people to meet your emotional and relational needs, Bobby warns, because you're not going to get them met here. Check your own urge to people please. Other selfish behavior certainly isn't your fault, but Levin says you'll want to make sure you're not indulging it, And if you realize you're locked in give, give, give mode, ask yourself what you're getting from that dynamic. Check yourself around giving to get, Levin suggests. Are you trying to buy love by overgiving and people-pleasing? When you do too much for others, often at your own expense, you enable the other person to keep asking. If you're not getting what you need, it may even be because you're afraid to ask, she continues. You may have your worthiness tied up in what you do, give, or produce. You'll be astonished at the energy that returns to you when you're able to release that. Our last article by Grant Reindner is Best Happiness Podcast That'll Uplift You. Podcast listening continues to skyrocket as we've all needed something to stay entertained and motivated through a turbulent year. Gritty true crime shows and eye-opening educational listens keep us enthralled, while mental health-centric series are helping people cope with unprecedented stress. We don't have to tell you just how difficult staying upbeat through it all can be. It's why we enlisted author and happiness expert Gretchen Rubin to answer reader questions on the topic. It's also why the subgenre of podcasts that deal with positivity, creativity, and healthy mental and physical habits is booming right now. Some of these happiness podcasts, like The Science of Happiness and The Gratitude Diaries, teach listeners how to find cheer. Others, like Questlove Supreme and Unqualified, feature hopeful and nourishing interviews, and pods like Who Weekly offer playful banter that makes fans feel like they're surrounded by friends. Whether you're looking to understand the mental health benefits of minimalist living, the best ways to overcome cognitive roadblocks, or simply to have a hearty laugh and forget about your troubles, one of these happiness podcasts will hopefully help you on your journey to seeking joy. The Science of Happiness Podcast. Some podcasts about living a better, cheerier life are anecdotal, but The Science of Happiness has the facts. Hosted by Dasher Keltner, founder of the University of California, Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center, the show explores topics like the value of outdoor time, connecting with your elders, and silencing your inner critic. Happier with Gretchen Rubin. In addition to writing books, Gretchen Rubin hosts Happier, which is an essential listen for those chasing a brighter outlook on life. Recent episodes have covered avoiding disappointment, the importance of friendly gestures, and how to trigger happy memories. The Kindness Podcast. On the show, journalist Nicole Phillips speaks to all kinds of noteworthy figures about the transformative powers of empathy and compassion. Over 100-plus episodes, Phillips has chatted with An Invisible Thread author Laura Schroff, multi-platinum singer-songwriter Jason Mraz, and the minds behind Minnesota's Fix It Forward Ministry, which helps give cars to those in need. Best Friends. Comedians Nicole Byer and Sasheer Zamata are riotously funny by themselves, so it makes sense that Best Friends, their joint pod, is a complete crack-up. The show has the loose, observational feel of a great stand-up set, with the hosts musing on everything from alien abductions to gigantic ladybugs to tattoos. If this sounds as freewheeling and gleefully weird as your late-night chats with a close pal, it's because it is. If extended quarantine has you feeling particularly isolated, Best Friends is a great remedy. 10% Happier with Dan Harris. Inspired by a panic attack he suffered while hosting Good Morning America, Dan Harris's 10% Happier is a comprehensive look at the myriad of factors that can get in the way of our joy and what to do about them. Harris brings in experts like Jenny Odell to discuss the psychological value of doing nothing, Annie Grace to talk frankly about battling addiction, and Adam Grant to muse on why it's okay to get things wrong. 10% also places a heavy emphasis on meditation, with regular weekly sessions guided by professionals appearing on the podcast feed. The Minimalists. Ryan Nicodemus and Joshua Fields Milburn's podcast focuses on the positive mental health impact of things like unfollowing superfluous social media accounts, helping your children get organized, and celebrating holidays without excessive consumerism. The Lively Show. The bubbly Jess Lively hosts this informative, motivational podcast, which focuses on the importance of a positive mindset for both personal and professional success. Roadblocks like negative feedback loops and fear of mortality are addressed in episodes, as are useful tools like proper breathing techniques and tips on living an aligned life. WHO Weekly. With hilarious hosts Bobby Finger and Lindsay Weber, each pop culture-centric episode focuses on a handful of stars and their exploits, offering funny and often incisive commentary on celebrity gossip. If your definition of happiness is gabbing about Page Six with your friends, this one is for you. Live Happy Now. The folks at Live Happy magazine have made your well-being their business, and their self-titled podcast offers deep dives into the minutiae of feeling good. Lively, informative interviews are conducted with experts on topics like mindful eating, stress management, and the dangers of toxic positivity. Mad Chat. The show focuses on pop cultural depictions of mental health, with the charming and irreverent Sandy Allen playing host. Alongside guests like Hannah Georges and Jonah Boswich, they've explored the way beloved properties like Donnie Darko and BoJack Horseman address psychological conditions like depression and anxiety. The Constant. It can be hard to brush off the little mistakes we make throughout the day, but it's important to remember that rarely do they reach historical proportions. That's what Mark Chrysler's The Constant covers: misconceptions, errors, and plans gone awry that have shaped history. Topics include the use of medicinal gold, cannibalism, and the flat earth conspiracy. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.